arrived at the Television Corporation's factory at Brentford.
"Do you mind waiting here a moment while I go and telephone?" asked Bernard.
The savage waited and watched. The main day shift was just going off duty. Crowds of lower-caste workers were queued up in front of the monorail station. 700 or 800 Gamma, Delta and Epsilon men and women, with not more than a dozen faces and statures between them. To each of them, with his or her ticket, the booking clerk pushed over a little cardboard pillbox. The long caterpillar of men and women moved slowly forward.
"What's in those?" remembering the Merchant of Venice. "Those caskets?"
the savage inquired, when Bernard had rejoined him.
"The day is summer ration,"
Bernard answered rather indistinctly, for he was masticating a piece of Benito Hoover's chewing gum.
"They get it after their work's over. 4 half-gram tablets, 6 on Saturdays."
He took John's arm affectionately, and they walked back towards the helicopter. Lenina came singing into the changing room.
"You seem very pleased with yourself," said Fanny.
"I am pleased," she answered. Zip. "Bernard rang up half an hour ago. Zip, zip." She stepped out of her shorts. "He has an unexpected engagement. Zip. Ask me if I take the savage to the feelers this evening. I must fly." She hurried away towards the bathroom.
"She's a lucky girl,"
Fanny said to herself as she watched Lenina go. There was no envy in the comment. Good-natured Fanny was merely stating a fact. Lenina was lucky. Lucky in having shared with Bernard a generous portion of the savage's immense celebrity. Lucky in reflecting from her insignificant person the moment's supremely fashionable glory. Had not the secretary of the Young Women's Fordian Association asked her to give her a lecture about her experiences? Had she not been invited to the annual dinner of the Aphroditeum Club? Had she not already appeared in the Feelytone News, visibly, audibly, and tactually appeared to countless millions all over the planet? Hardly less flattering had been the attentions paid her by conspicuous individuals. The resident world controller's second secretary had asked her to dinner and breakfast. She had spent one weekend with the Ford Chief Justice and another with the arch-community songster of Canterbury. The president of the Internal and External Secretions Corporation was perpetually on the phone, and she had been to Deauville with the deputy governor of the Bank of Europe. "It was wonderful, of course, and yet in a way," she had confessed to Fanny, "I feel as though I were getting something on false pretenses. But, of course, the first thing they all want to know is what it's like to make love to a savage. And I have to say, I don't know." She shook her head. "Most of the men don't believe me, of course. But it's true. I wish it weren't," she added sadly and sighed. "He's terribly good-looking, don't you think so?"
"But doesn't he like you?" asked Fanny.
"Sometimes I think he does, and sometimes I think he doesn't. He always does his best to avoid me, goes out of the room when I come in, won't touch me, won't even look at me. But sometimes if I turn round suddenly, I catch him staring. And then, well, you know how men look when they like you." Yes, Fanny knew. "I can't make it out," said Lenina. She couldn't make it out, and not only was bewildered, but also rather upset. "Because, you see, Fanny, I like him." Liked him more and more. Well, now there'd be a real chance, she thought, as she scented herself after the bath. Dab, 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 a real chance. Her high spirits overflowed in song.
"Hug me till you drug me, honey, kiss me till I'm in a coma, hug me, honey, struggly bunny, love's as good as soma."
The scent organ was playing a delightfully refreshing herbal capriccio, rippling arpeggios of thyme and lavender, of rosemary, basil, myrtle, tarragon, a series of daring modulations through the spice keys into ambergris, and a slow return through sandalwood, camphor, cedar, and new-mown hay, with occasional subtle touches of discord, a whiff of kidney pudding, the faintest suspicion of pig's dung, back to the simple aromatics with which the piece began. The final blast of time died away. There was a round of applause. The lights went up. In the synthetic music machine, the soundtrack roll began to unwind. It was a trio for hyperviolin, supercello, and oboe surrogate that now filled the air with its agreeable languor. 30 or 40 bars, and then, against this instrumental background, a much more than human voice began to warble, now throaty, now from the head, now hollow as a flute, now charged with yearning harmonics. It effortlessly passed from Gaspard Forster's slow record on the very frontiers of musical tone to a trilled bat note high above the highest C to which, in 1770, at the Ducal Opera of Parma, and to the astonishment of Mozart, Lucrezia Adjugari, alone of all the singers in history, once piercingly gave utterance. Sunk in their pneumatic stalls, Leniner and the savage sniffed and listened. It was now the turn also for eyes and skin. The house lights went down. Fiery letters stood out solid, as though self-supported in the darkness.
3 weeks in a helicopter, an all-super-singing, synthetic-talking, colored, stereoscopic feely, with synchronized scent organ accompaniment.
"Take hold of those metal knobs on the arms of your chair," whispered Leniner. "Otherwise you won't get any of the feely effect." The savage did as he was told.
Those fiery letters, meanwhile, had disappeared. There were 10 seconds of complete darkness. Then suddenly, dazzling and incomparably more solid-looking than they would have been in actual flesh and blood, far more real than reality, there stood the stereoscopic images, locked in one another's arms, of a gigantic Negro and a golden-haired young brachycephalic beta-plus female. The savage started. That sensation on his lips. He lifted a hand to his mouth. The titillation ceased. Let his hand fall back on the metal knob. It began again. The scent organ, meanwhile, breathed pure musk. Expiringly, a soundtrack superdove cooed, "Ooh, ooh," and vibrating only 32 times a second, a deeper-than-African bass made answer, "Ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah." The stereoscopic lips came together again, and once more the facial erogenous zones of the 6,000 spectators in the Alhambra tingled with almost intolerable galvanic pleasure. Ooh! The plot of the film was extremely simple. A few minutes after the first oohs and ahs, a duet having been sung, and a little love made on that famous bearskin, every hair of which, the assistant predestinator was perfectly right, could be separately and distinctly felt, the Negro had a helicopter accident, fell on his head, thump! What a twinge through the forehead. A chorus of "ows" and "ayes" went up from the audience. The concussion knocked all the Negro's conditioning into a cocked hat. He developed for the beta blonde an exclusive and maniacal passion. She protested, he persisted. There were struggles, pursuits, an assault on arrival, finally a sensational kidnapping. The beta blonde was ravished away into the sky and kept there, hovering for 3 weeks in a wildly antisocial tete-a-tete with the black madman. Finally, after a whole series of adventures and much aerial acrobacy, 3 handsome young alphas succeeded in rescuing her. The Negro was packed off to an adult reconditioning center, and the film ended happily and decorously, with the beta blonde becoming the mistress of all her 3 rescuers. They interrupted themselves for a moment to sing a synthetic quartet with full super-orchestral accompaniment and gardenias on the scent organ. Then the bearskin made a final appearance, and amid a blare of saxophones, the last stereoscopic kiss faded into darkness. The last electric titillation died on the lips like a dying moth that quivers, quivers, ever more feebly, ever more faintly, and at last is quite, quite still. But for Leniner, the moth did not completely die. Even after the lights had gone up, while they were shuffling slowly along with the crowd towards the lifts,
its ghost still fluttered against her lips, still traced fine, shuddering roads of anxiety and pleasure across her skin. Her cheeks were flushed, her eyes dewily bright, her breath came deeply. She caught hold of the savage's arm and pressed it, limp, against her side. He looked down at her for a moment, pale, pained, desiring, and ashamed of his desire. He was not worthy, not... Their eyes, for a moment, met. What treasures hers promised! A queen's ransom of temperament! Hastily he looked away, disengaged his imprisoned arm. He was obscurely terrified, lest she should cease to be something he could feel himself unworthy of.
"I don't think you ought to see things like that," he said,
making haste to transfer from Lenina herself to the surrounding circumstances the blame for any past or possible future lapse from perfection.
"Things like what, John?"
"Like this horrible film."
"Horrible?"
Lenina was genuinely astonished.
"But I thought it was lovely."
"It was base," he said indignantly. "It was ignoble."
She shook her head.
"I don't know what you mean."
Why was he so queer? Why did he go out of his way to spoil things? In the taxicopter, he hardly even looked at her. Bound by strong vows that had never been pronounced, obedient to laws that had long since ceased to run, he sat averted and in silence. Sometimes, as though a finger had plucked at some taut, almost breaking string, his whole body would shake with a sudden nervous start. The taxicopter landed on the roof of Lenina's apartment house.
"At last," she thought exultantly, as she stepped out of the cab. "At last, even though he had been so queer just now."
Standing under a lamp, she peered into her hand mirror. At last. Yes, her nose was a bit shiny. She shook the loose powder from her puff. While he was paying off the taxi, there would be just time. She rubbed at the shininess, thinking, "He's terribly good-looking. No need for him to be shy like Bernard. And yet any other man would have done it long ago." Well, now at last. That fragment of a face in the little round mirror suddenly smiled at her.
"Good night,"
said a strangled voice behind her. Lenina wheeled round. He was standing in the doorway of the cab, his eyes fixed, staring. Had evidently been staring all this time while she was powdering her nose, waiting. But what for? Or hesitating, trying to make up his mind, and all the time thinking, thinking. She could not imagine what extraordinary thoughts.
"Good night, Lenina,"
he repeated, and made a strange, grimacing attempt to smile.
"But, John, I thought you were... I mean, aren't you?"
He shut the door and bent forward to say something to the driver. The cab shot up into the air. Looking down through the window in the floor, the savage could see Lenina's upturned face, pale in the bluish light of the lamps. The mouth was open. She was calling. Her foreshortened figure rushed away from him. The diminishing square of the roof seemed to be falling through the darkness. 5 minutes later, he was back in his room. From its hiding place, he took out his mouse-nibbled volume, turned with religious care its stained and crumpled pages, and began to read Othello. Othello, he remembered, was like the hero of 3 weeks in a helicopter, a black man. Drying her eyes, Lenina walked across the roof to the lift. On her way down to the 27th floor, she pulled out her Soma bottle. 1 gram, she decided, would not be enough. Hers had been more than a 1 gram affliction. But if she took 2 grams, she ran the risk of not waking up in time tomorrow morning. She compromised, and, into her cupped left palm, shook out 3 half-gram tablets. Chapter 12. Bernard had to shout through the locked door. The savage would not open.
"But everybody's there, waiting for you."
"Let them wait,"
came back the muffled voice through the door.
"But you know quite well, John!"
How difficult it was to sound persuasive at the top of one's voice.
"I asked them on purpose to meet you. You ought to have asked me first whether I wanted to meet them." "But you always came before, John. That's precisely why I don't want to come again." "Just to please me?"
Bernard bellowingly wheedled.
"Won't you come to please me?"
"No."
"Do you seriously mean it?"
"Yes." Despairingly.
"But what shall I do?"
Bernard wailed.
"Go to hell!"
bawled the exasperated voice from within.
"But the arch-community songster of Canterbury is there tonight!"
Bernard was almost in tears.
"Oya takwa!"
It was only in Zuni that the savage could adequately express what he felt about the arch-community songster.
"Hani!"
he added as an afterthought, and then, with what derisive ferocity,
"Sonzi sotsina!"
And he spat on the ground as Popeye might have done. In the end, Bernard had to slink back, diminished, to his rooms, and inform the impatient assembly that the savage would not be appearing that evening. The news was received with indignation. The men were furious at having been tricked into behaving politely with this insignificant fellow with the unsavory reputation and the heretical opinions. The higher their position in the hierarchy, the deeper their resentment.
"To play such a joke on me," the arch-songster kept repeating, "on me."
As for the women, they indignantly felt that they had been had on false pretenses, had by a wretched little man who had had alcohol poured into his bottle by mistake, by a creature with a gamma-minus physique. It was an outrage, and they said so more and more loudly. The headmistress of Eton was particularly scathing. Lenina alone said nothing. Pale, her blue eyes clouded with an unwonted melancholy, she sat in a corner, cut off from those who surrounded her by an emotion which they did not share. She had come to the party filled with a strange feeling of anxious exultation. "In a few minutes," she had said to herself as she entered the room, "I shall be seeing him, talking to him, telling him," for she had come with her mind made up, "that I like him more than anybody I've ever known. And then perhaps he'll say..." What would he say? The blood had rushed to her cheeks. Why was he so strange the other night, after the feelies? So queer. And yet I'm absolutely sure he really does rather like me. I'm sure. It was at this moment that Bernard had made his announcement. The savage wasn't coming to the party. Lenina suddenly felt all the sensations normally experienced at the beginning of a violent passion surrogate treatment, a sense of dreadful emptiness, a breathless apprehension, a nausea. Her heart seemed to stop beating. "Perhaps it's because he doesn't like me," she said to herself, and at once this possibility became an established certainty. John had refused to come because he didn't like her. He didn't like her. "It really is a bit too thick," the headmistress of Eton was saying to the director of crematoria and phosphorus reclamation, "when I think that I actually..."
"Yes," came the voice of Fanny Crown. "It's absolutely true about the alcohol. Someone I know knew someone who was working at the embryo store at the time. She said to my friend, and my friend said to me..."
"Too bad, too bad," said Henry Foster, sympathizing with the arch-community songster. "It may interest you to know that our ex-director was on the point of transferring him to Iceland." Pierced by every word that was spoken, the tight balloon of Bernard's happy self-confidence was leaking from a thousand wounds. Pale, distraught, abject and agitated, he moved among his guests, stammering incoherent apologies, assuring them that next time the savage would certainly be there, begging them to sit down and take a carotene sandwich, a slice of vitamin A pâté, a glass of champagne surrogate. They duly ate, but ignored him, drank, and were either rude to his face